a socialist society after day one of the revolution. You seem to forget that the working class is in charge of all of the real work, or rather does all the real work in society. The fact that we do it at the behest of the owning class is irrelevant. We do all the stuff that's needed to be done already. What we're talking about now, what we'll be talking about in a run-up to a socialist society will be a discussion amongst workers as to exactly what Pat was saying about what are the actual useful jobs and what we're going to do about getting the people that currently do the useless stuff in society, getting them into something that will benefit everybody else. I think our issue, the only thing that we can talk about at this stage is the productive system. Well, we already run the productive system, so to change it over from running it for the owners or running it for human need, that's not an issue. That's going to be. The relationship is in, or rather, the repression is in our heads. There is no barrier other than our acceptance of the claims of the ruling class to own things. That's the issue. And as to this thing about the freeloaders, well, okay, you already know what I'm going to say. How many are there already? But ignore that. Ignore the fact that we've got all these freeloaders at present. What we've got, we've actually got all this useless work being done, haven't we? We've got all the nonsense to do with the exchange system, all the nonsense to do with weaponry and so on. But by releasing that, what we're actually doing is we're going to have a society where labour is less onerous on everybody. And even if there are, I can quite well imagine that there will be people in a socialist society that have been so damaged by capitalism that they could well never ever contribute. But what we're also talking about is a conscious working class, a conscious working class that takes the power and will carry on the discipline of our class into the future society. So they're going to be able to cope with, going to understand these degenerates that are incapable of contributing to social well-being. And yeah, okay. Yes, I went off on one there. Do you want to answer me, Paddy? Because nobody. Oh, okay. If you don't mind, John, I'll offer Paddy to ask Paddy to come in first if he wants.
Well. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll try and be quick. There are two things, I think. The first is, we don't need to fling the party case at each other. We know what we think about this. But we're supposing, aren't we, that I'm interested in the practicalities. I'm not interested in, you know, party. World's working class being class conscious, that's a given. That has to happen. What I'm interested in is how they actually operate on day one. There has to be, I think, a long tail before day one in order for day one to actually not fall flat on its face. And I'm wondering what happens if the state tries to prevent this discussion, but you think that they can't? Okay, all right, fine, maybe they can't. The second thing is, how long does this long tail need to be? A year? How about 2 years? Well, how about 10 years? In fact, how do we know when the long tail is supposed to start? And how do we know that we shouldn't have already started it? Because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Those of us around before the Berlin Wall went down, I think, can all confidently attest to the fact that none of us saw it coming. And this is what you get with the future. None of us see it coming. And so how do we know when we should be starting this long tail if we're not already doing it? Why aren't we doing it? So that was the one thing. The other thing was about the practicalities. If you just take the UK for a minute, it gets huge amounts of imports. Most countries do. There's a huge amount of maritime traffic, gigantic amount. I can't remember the figures, but you all know this. We get in the UK, for example, you know, you've got 25% of you know, our food is Mediterranean fruit, veg imports. We also get steel, rubber, coffee, chocolate, medicines, a lot of medical supplies from Europe. The list goes on and on and on, okay? Now, all of that has got to be guaranteed prior to day one. All of that has got to be worked out during the long tail, because if the money all just gets turned off like a tap, all the shipping will stop. If there's no plan in place, and if all the shipping stops, then a lot of the societies are going to have nothing, and they won't be set up for self-sustainability, being self-sufficient. You know, they will probably be aiming at doing that, but they won't be set up for it. So you've got massive practical problems, and this is, I think, gets to the nub of what Pat was asking. It's like, yeah, it's all very well talking in generalities, but how does it specifically work? How do you get seafarers, whatever you call them, sailors, who, you know, it's a dangerous job. There's no question about it. It's one of the most dangerous jobs you can do after, I think, mining is being on a merchant ship. How do we persuade those people carry on doing what you're doing? Well, there's probably 10 other things they would rather be doing. But we're saying to them, no, you've got to keep carrying on what you're doing, because we in the UK, we need the medicines, we need the rubber, we need the coffee, we need the chocolate, we need our treats, we need all those things. You've got to keep doing your dangerous job, okay? I'm not saying there's no answer to that, but I am saying it involves practicalities that we are just not bothering to deal with. We are just kicking it into the long grass and waiting for someone else to come along and figure it out. And I don't think that's good enough.
Okay, let's see if John wants to answer that. John, come in, please. Comrade, come in. You need to unmute if you're trying to speak. I'll come back to you in a minute, comrade. Come in. Adam, do you want to come in?
I think Paddy undermined his whole argument when he was talking about the draft of the Socialism as a Practical Alternative pamphlet. I mean, he pointed out himself that there's no mention in it of computers. I mean, surely that's the whole point. We cannot say now. What are we, a couple of hundred people? We cannot say now what circumstances are going to be like immediately before or during or after the social revolution. So there isn't much point in entering into exact details. I mean, we had an article once that was submitted to the Socialist Standard by a member, and his view was that on Monday, socialism would be established and money would be abolished, so that everybody would go out the previous weekend and spend all their money. And there's a publication that came out, I think it was in the 80s, called When the Pubs Close. And what he said about us was, all discussions at SBGB meetings end up with a discussion about how nice socialism will be. And in fact, nearly every discussion we've had on Discord has also ended up like that. But okay, we don't need to go into all the details, precisely because one, as Paddy said, in the position he was when he was stating the position he was trying to criticize. we don't know what the exact conditions are going to be. And two, it's arrogant and undemocratic of us now today, a few hundred people, to dictate what will happen. I think that, you know, that position still stands. I think I also think actually that most people are attracted to the case for socialism because they don't like capitalism, not because they think socialism is a nice system of society. But to come back to the other socialists, I mean this thin red line of left communists and council communists and some anarchists. As Paddy himself pointed out, they seem to be fixated on what happened in Russia. I think, Alan mentioned this. There are other people out there who I think are saying more interesting things than they do. That's Peter Joseph and Zeitgeist. I mean, they've made the point that they don't use the word socialist. Will be a world society. So the first thing you've got to do is have a survey of world resources. I mean, this is a much more useful thing to do than discussing labour time vouchers. But basically, I think I fundamentally disagree with Paddy's approach, which he brings up, in fact, at every meeting. I think that our traditional position is okay. That we can't dictate the future. Because we don't know what the technological conditions, or the political conditions, or the social conditions are going to be, and it's up to the socialist working class at the time to deal with these things if they happen. If the state tries to suspend democracy, these are all hypotheticals, but I don't think it's worth trying to give definite answers to. We just say the working class, the socialists at the time will deal with them. Deal with the situation in the light of the circumstances. Then I don't think anything wrong with that particular position. Yeah, I see. Alan has found the words I was looking for: resource-based economy, which is what Zeitgeist stand for. And I think they've done quite a bit of interesting stuff on this. I think we should look to them rather than to people who look back to the Russian Revolution. Okay, that's my counter argument to Paddy.
Okay. John, come in. You want to come in?
Yes.
Go ahead, comrade.
Right. Over 50 years ago, the Socialist Party knew that it was nowhere near socialism, and consequently, it would be quite futile to give a detailed explanation or blueprint, if you like, of how socialism would work. We're a very tiny organisation, an insignificant part of the world's working class. Now, at that time, even a few years, more than 50 years ago, I knew that I would never see socialism. But nonetheless, what I did think was that perhaps towards the end of my life, I might see a larger socialist party. Well, nothing like that has happened. And in fact, we've become much smaller than we once were. So it seems even more ludicrous 50 years later, and we're still nowhere near the socialist revolution, that we should be able to give some kind of blueprint as to how socialism might work. That shouldn't prevent us, incidentally, from looking at certain means of producing wealth that could be developed more in a socialist society. But I think we have done that in the past anyway, and we could perhaps do that. We could definitely do that in the future. But as for the use of labour time vouchers, I'm afraid that any society that we the working classes, that is, were trying to establish that necessitated the use, or we thought necessitated the use of labour time vouchers, that such a society wouldn't be socialism, whatever it was. And the notion that there would be freeloaders, well, while there's going to be these so-called freeloaders that would have such a negative impact on socialism, that might just mean that the revolution's delayed. We can't do anything. We can't move forward. But on the other hand, we have freeloaders today. They're called capitalists, and society can function without almost any reference to them, apart from the fact that they're able to exercise their property rights, of course. We also have others that are forced to be freeloaders, workers who are not allowed to work because capitalism can't profitably exploit them, so they're kept as part of an industrial reserve. So, you know, it's not really for us who desire this desirable end to explain every jot and tittle of how it's going to actually work, especially since we're nowhere near establishing socialism. It's one of those things that seems so near yet so far, as you might say, because technically, you know, it does seem very feasible, but on the other hand, the workers' minds are not ready for it, and we've got a long, long way to go in terms of that. Now, that could happen all of a sudden, apparently, but I think if you're talking about consciousness, I think there would be more detectable signs of it than we've already seen. Not that we haven't seen any, but just not enough. So that's all I have to say for the moment.
Okay. Paddy, do you want to come back in before I bring Moggy in?
Well, it's just a few things there. I mean, yeah. I mean, John just said, you know, workers aren't ready for socialism. I mean, at one level, yeah, I mean, that's pretty self-evidently the case. But, I mean, you know, Adam mentioned Zeitgeist. And at their peak, you know, Peter Joseph's outfit at its peak was in hundreds of thousands across, you know, many, many countries. Now, I know there were issues with, you know, the kind of membership as such. I mean, there was no membership. You just sent in your email address and that was it, you remember. And there was bugger all democracy in the thing. But, you know, Adam is very fond of Peter Joseph's, and, you know, understandably. But, you know, that fizzled out. But it doesn't mean that there's no appetite for this. I think that in another way, John's a bit, you know, not right. You know, I think there are sufficient a number of workers out there who are ready for these ideas, but I think that they're, you know, they're probably, they may not join us because who the hell are we? But, you know, who they do join depends on who's answering the questions they're asking. And I don't think it's about dictating. Adam used this word dictate. I never use the word dictate. I don't like having words put in my mouth like that. We wouldn't be dictating and we wouldn't be creating a blueprint. John talks about a blueprint, which incidentally is an example. That word blueprint is an example of precisely what Adam was talking about of, you know, new technology making old terms obsolete. Nobody uses blueprints nowadays. But the fact that if in 1904 we'd had a description of how socialism might work, this was only 3 years, I think, after Marconi first sent a wireless message across the Atlantic. We forget how long ago that was. You know, if we'd been describing socialism back then, of course it would be hansom cabs and, you know, a telephone in every town. But what you would do is you would make a best guess based on the current technology available, and you would say, this is a best guess based on the current technology, and then you would update that best guess whenever the technology changes. That is what a rational approach would look like. What we do is we don't even bother asking the question, and then we make a virtue of our own insouciance by never dealing with that issue. And then we trot out phrases like dictate and blueprint to anybody that dares to challenge the orthodoxy. I think that's wrong. I think it's silly. I think workers have a right to expect sensible answers to their questions and not things like, oh, it'll be worked out at some point in the future, which is what people are saying now. That isn't the way to impress people. That's not the way to, persuade people. Adam's quite right. Every after pub discussion is about socialism. But I said that in my talk. I said this is what we talk about after the pub shuts, but we don't talk about it in our published propaganda. You don't see it in standard articles because members don't write those kinds of articles. You don't see it in pamphlets. You don't see it in talks. we don't do it. We avoid the whole subject. And like I said before, I think this is a mistake. And I think it continues to be a mistake that is being supported by an orthodox sort of view, which, you know, leaves us sitting back in 1904 with no more idea now how things would work than we had back then.
Okay, thanks. Moggy, do you want to come in?
Thank you. Yes, one thing that worries me a lot is it's all very well trying to have a socialist revolution, and it's something that will happen in time and gradually. But we've got a huge elephant in the room, which is China. China is a very big country. It has an enormous population, which occupies a very, very large proportion of the Earth's population. They are not going to be swayed in any way. They are not going to learn English. They are not going to change their capitalist ideas. They are working very hard to turn the whole world into their way of thinking. And they've done this by setting up Confucius Institutes attached to universities all over the world. And I've seen it happen in New Zealand. I saw it happen from when the first Confucius Institute opened in New Zealand, where the Chinese government sent so many Mandarin language teachers over. The Chinese government paid for them to come over. They placed them in schools. And they were doubling the number every year. And it was only the pandemic that put a stop to it. The last year they did, it was the year before the pandemic, and they brought in 2,000 Mandarin language teachers, which they placed in schools all over New Zealand. And the year the pandemic started, they were going to bring in 4,000 Mandarin language teachers. The whole idea was to have Mandarin as the dominant language in New Zealand. And I assume they were doing it with other countries too. But this is something that I think it took the New Zealand government a long while to twig what was happening, because just before the pandemic started, when the Confucius Institute said they were going to bring in 4,000 Mandarin language teachers, the New Zealand government said, no, we'll have 30. And so they built it up from the first year when they brought 9 teachers in, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And then the New Zealand government realised what was happening and said, no, we'll just cut it right back. So if we hadn't had the pandemic, New Zealand would probably have Mandarin spoken in every school in New Zealand by now. And maybe this is happening in other countries. So I think this is going to be a big problem. And I think this is going to be the biggest hurdle that we have to establishing world socialism. So I'd like to hear other people's comments on that, please.
Okay, thanks, Moggy. If I might make a comment, what the Chinese state is doing at the moment is exactly what the British have done for years with the British Council. It's what the French government have done with the Alliance Française, the Americans do with various bodies that they've got. So it shouldn't come as any surprise to you. And by the way, you said that you seem to think that it'd be a really bad idea. I've just been looking at the China Labour Bulletin, And it's very frustrating. And what that is supposedly some somewhat independent body that monitors trade union activity on the Chinese mainland. And there are reports on there about people taking strike action and so on. Unfortunately, all the references to it lead you to Chinese, naturally enough, Chinese language sources. So I can't read those. It would be a damn good idea if we could speak, if there are more and more workers that are able to speak Chinese so that we can talk to our fellow workers over there. I'm sorry, that's a little bit flippant, but I can see we obviously know that states do expanding capitalist economies of all stripes are going to try to influence the ideology and the culture of the client states. I do apologise. I seem to have abused the chairman's privilege there. Does anybody, Paddy, do you want to come back on what Moggy said?
I don't think you were abusing it, Steve. There wasn't anybody in the queue, so that's fine. Yeah, what you said about strikes, though, I mean, I agree. I was thinking the same thing. I was talking to somebody the other day who's in contact with a Chinese communist group, left communist group again, who has said, there are a lot of strikes in China that perhaps we don't hear about them over here, but there are a lot of strikes. My other theory, I mean, Adam wants to come in a sec, but he can. I thought he doesn't agree with this, but the theory I've had is that China seems unstoppable at the moment because they've had a 30-year massive growth spurt, and but so they're kind of new to capitalism, or at least sort of Western style capitalism, and what they haven't had that you always inevitably see in capitalist economies is a crisis of overproduction and an economic crash. And I wonder what will happen to, the Chinese one-party system if and when that actually happens. Will they look quite as much of a tiger then? I mean, history suggests that they won't. This will take the wind out of their sails somewhat. But anyway, that's all I've got to say on that.
Okay, Comrade Buick.
Am I unmuted? Am I?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I just want to come back. I mean, actually, Paddy's made the point that there are left communist groups, or in fact, left Maoist groups, even that do have come to the same sort of conclusion as to the alternative to capitalism. I mean, because the Cultural Revolution got out of hand, and some of the groups took it literally. They may actually be speaking Cantonese and not Mandarin Chinese, because they're from, a lot of them are in Hong Kong. But there are also groups in Japan that are part of this thin red line. I mean, they probably veered more towards the vanguardist idea, but they have the same objective as us. So I don't think we should necessarily be afraid that when we get socialism at the first meeting of the World Council, most of the delegates won't be Europeans, but they'll be from China. So I think we mustn't see China as a threat. Fu Manchu and all this sort of nonsense, which is quite popular, I think, in Australia. I didn't realise it was popular in New Zealand. I thought they were a bit more developed there. Against the threat of a Chinese takeover.
Yeah. Okay. I've just put a reference in the to the website that I mentioned about the situation in China. It's actually based in Hong Kong. It'd be interesting to see how long it can continue in existence with the repression that's going on there. Comrade Cumming, do you want to come back in, please?
Yes, the old men that rule China today are terrified of their wage slaves, and this is part of the reason why they're clamping down and trying to turn the clock backwards as rapidly as they can, but it's something that is doomed to failure. Well, if it's not, and if they are able to continue in their present trend forever, that's just counter to what has happened generally within capitalism. There is ups and downs within capitalist economies. So I don't think there's anything to be unduly concerned about there. Chinese imperialism today is somewhat different from Western-style imperialism of earlier centuries. But there's clubs in Africa where the Chinese are allowed in, and the same clubs were used by the British when they were there. And now the local people still don't have access to these clubs because, guess what, it's Chinese imperialists who can use them and the locals can't use them. So that's one aspect of the imperialism that has remained pretty similar. But the ruling class does use different techniques in different parts of the world. And I don't think we should worry unduly about that. What we should be concerned about is helping Chinese workers in China to understand their position and urge them to deal with their own capitalist class, just as we have to do, and just as throughout Europe, other parts of the world will have to come to terms. There's all sorts of parts of the world which at the moment look very, very backward, but things can change. And after all, in China, we did have Tiananmen Square, it was probably just a movement for some sort of limited political democracy, but nonetheless, it was a movement for something that could be termed progressive. Now, that's not even allowed to be mentioned in China today, but the fact that you can't mention something doesn't mean that you can't think something. And the Chinese government does say that, of course, the citizen has freedom of thought. And they do emphasise that. Yes, you have freedom of thought, but not freedom to act. Well, we knew that. And workers in China already know that. But they do have some techniques which they use in some of their strikes, for example, in trying to prevent themselves from being victimised by their capitalist masters. So I'm quite confident that, assuming human society continues to exist, that workers in China will come to terms with their capitalists just as we'll deal with our capitalists here.
Okay, thanks, Comrade. Comrade Johnston.
It's just to return back to really the topic. I'm very much in the cornucopia camp of socialists, that I do think that there will be capability and potential of vast abundance. And I don't accept Paddy's critique that it will be like Henry Ford, everybody will have a car, but it will be black. I think there will be a variety and cultural initiatives all over the world. But what I want to really say is that we should actually embrace the term utopian. I think Marx, when he was criticising the utopian socialists, we're not criticising the fact that of what they were trying to achieve, but how they were going to achieve it. I don't think the term impossibilist should be disparaged either. We should embrace our ambitions, and when I have arguments, it's not with the fellow members of the Thin Red Line on abundance, it's with the environmentalists, the neo-Malthusians, and they're apparently young, radical, active, but they have this 17th century concept from Thomas Malthus that Sylvia Pankhurst turned around and critiqued as austerity and scarcity and are not the ambitions of the socialists. We really do have this capability of abundance. I think Paddy's done quite a lot in socialist standards to reveal the robotics, the automation, capabilities that's being hindered and not expanded. And yes, I think also Paddy has revealed in his socialist standard articles of how democracy is enhanced by the computers that we've got today, of the mobile phone apps that a farmer in India can get up-to-date monsoon reports with a touch of a keyboard, keypad. So I think the party is actually underplays itself by not embracing abundance like the zeitgeist. We could actually, as Adam said, improve on their ideas by actually showing that they are practical and they're not high in the sky ambitions. So really, I think we actually should be emphasising our utopianism, our impossibilism, and making the argument that fully automated luxury communism is very possible and should be a reality and not something postponed for a few science fiction centuries from now.
Okay, Alan, thank you. Comrade Deutsch? Comrade, you need to unmute.
Yes. Having difficulty doing it. Yes, well, discussion this evening, and I feel a bit more confident about what I was thinking in my difficulty of how to answer the question. I agree that we don't have to give details. We are a tiny group, and we can't give a plan for the whole world, and we don't need to. It has to be a worldwide solution, and capitalism is worldwide, and there's such interconnectedness, if I can use that word, between the different countries now. I think the answer for the shipping problem that Paddy was suggesting is that it's a worldwide solution, that there wouldn't be the shipping company is still expecting to be paid in money. That would surely be something organised before then, because some of these things that are shipped about anyway wouldn't need to be shipped about in the same way. Things would go down the world to be made up and then come back again. And I'm sorry, I haven't got a specific example at this minute. That's the sort of thing that happened. But that question really wouldn't arise, which doesn't mean that there wouldn't be some sort of teething troubles, which would be resolved because money wouldn't be a factor. It would simply be, this is the best way of doing it, or that's the best way of doing it, and putting it out in that way. Those things I don't see as being a problem. So that's it then. Bye.
Thank you, comrade. I'll take Fraser, and then I'll ask Paddy to come back in.
Yes, I was reading Ragged Trouser Philanthropist, and it goes on about how they're going to manage the demand of people to do all the good jobs, and people and avoiding all the bad jobs like sweeping the streets or something, you know. So what he suggested there was raise the qualifications for all the high demand jobs, like surgery or becoming a doctor or a teacher or something like that, give anybody who wants to do the low status jobs, which I think inevitably it might be, they have more days off and better standards, that would sort of counterbalance the demand for the high status and low status jobs as well. Coming back to that technical problem of poor jobs with lack of health and safety, and quite dangerous jobs, but those jobs are dangerous, and they're like working down mines. In particular, we're talking about Chinese China mines down there. They have got such a phenomenal amount of mortality down there and working in a mine. That's that's due to real capitalist exploitations and really forcing people through the wage slavery to go down there and put up with such dangerous conditions. What we should really emphasise is that under socialism, we would have the technology, we'd implement the technology that it wouldn't be for profit. It would be for the for the use, for the well-being of workers, and if not, alternatives, viable alternatives, will be found. That's all my contribution is.
Okay, thanks, Fred. Sorry, I can see an entry from Danny in the speaking queue, but he's disappeared from the meeting. Can anybody see where Danny's gone? I can't. Okay. Paddy, I'm gonna ask you, do you want to come and do a bit of a summing up? It's 9:10. Okay, I'll give you the floor, and then I think couple of things that I'd like to raise after the discussion's finished, if people don't mind hanging about. So, do you want to go ahead, Paddy?
Okay. Well, Fraser was saying about the in the ragged trouser philanthropist about who would do what jobs. That just reminded me that something else that some of these advocates for labour time vouchers, they were saying, who would do the dirty jobs? I said before that left communists didn't, they understood all these human nature arguments, but sometimes I wonder, and with this kind of question, you sort of start to realise that some people are just not on the same page at all. Their answer to how you get people to do the dirty jobs was pay them a higher rate of labour time voucher, an enhanced labour time voucher. I mean, what the hell? They're approaching this question from a sort of capitalist / 1917 mindset. They're not at all looking at work the way that I think socialists would look at it and the way that we look at it. So I think that they've not understood the basic nature of what work means to human beings at all by saying that they would pay, higher LTVs. But that's beside the point. Just a couple of things I wanted to say. I just think, this argument, yes, we're a tiny group and we can't give a picture of socialism. I don't know. A lot of people here have read that book by Ursula Le Guin, where she paints a pretty, persuasive picture of an anarchist society. All right, it's science fiction, but even so, it's a pretty well-rounded out picture. And she was in an even tinier group than us. She was in a tiny group of one, and she managed to do it, and we've had 118 years and we've not even come close, you know. So I just offer that observation. Lastly, a couple of things. You know, somebody said, can't remember who, this fully, oh, I think Alan, fully automated luxury communism. He likes that idea. I like it too, Alan. I do like it, but I'm just not convinced that workers will see that it's feasible. I think that I worry that workers will treat it as a joke. I mean, if loads and, you know, if workers flock to this idea of fully automated luxury communism, I'm absolutely, I'd be happy to, you know, admit I'm wrong on that. But, you know, let's see what happens. In the same vein, someone mentioned, I think it was possibly, in fact, it was Alan again. He likes this term utopia. And I remember Ron Cook in our Birmingham branch, he wrote a book called Yes, Utopia, because he just thought, well, this was a word that we should reclaim. I sort of see the argument, but the thing is, everybody knows that the word utopia means nowhere. So you really are celebrating nowhere. So I think that kind of shoots itself in the foot. And if you look at how, you know, Marx and Engels described utopian socialists, they were saying these are people who, well, you know, quite apart from the idea that they have, they may have had the right idea. The problem wasn't the idea. It was the fact that they didn't locate it in its historical context. In other words, how you get from here to there, and what are the material conditions required, and what are the, you know, the practicalities of it. And I suppose I'm kind of saying the same thing about this, is that we're also not locating the practicalities of socialism within the historical context of where we're at right now. And I'll repeat it because it bears repeating. This is not a blueprint. This is not something we dictate. It's a work in progress that needs continual updating as the tech progresses. And that is really this what this argument is in a nutshell. And any attempt to make it out that it's some sort of boilerplate or engraved in granite description is simply, you know, a distortion. So, okay. So I'll leave it there.
Well, I've got a contribution from Moggy. I'll take that. Moggy, please, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, it's just this thing about these Labour time vouchers. Of course it's not going to work. For a start, you're going to have a world shortage of concert pianists. Well, not just concert pianists, but any people who get paid for an hour's work, but they've had to do many, many hundreds of hours to prepare for doing that 1 hour of paid work. So it's anyone who works in any aspect of the arts, or anyone who, well, like surgeons who've had to do a very, very long apprenticeship to be able to do the job that they do. So I don't see how you can work that out at all. And then this thing about people, you know, saying, oh, who's going to go out and do the dirty jobs? Well, maybe we wouldn't have any dirty jobs. Maybe we wouldn't need things that come out of mines. We might be able to organise our lives so we don't have to dig in the ground and take things out of mines. Maybe we can have robots and various machines that can do the dirty jobs. Or the dirty jobs or the unskilled jobs, maybe they can be done on a sort of voluntary part-time basis, so that people wouldn't mind just doing 1 hour a week doing some onerous job that's not very nice, but because it's helping all mankind and it's making the world a better place for other people. So if you're only doing it for 1 hour a week or 1 hour a month or something, you don't mind doing it. It's when you get people stuck in horrible jobs that they don't enjoy doing it and they're having to do it 40 hours a week. So I think we've just got a whole different way of thinking. But I don't think these Labour time vouchers would work at all. Right, that's mine.
Okay, thank you. With the meeting's permission, I'm going to draw that to a close.